Let me begin by saying that I was really happy to receive and to accept the invitation to be your guest speaker as you set out to put living flesh around the mission statement you recently adopted. I know the hard work and creative imagination that goes into the creation of such a statement, for I was your minister at the time when you worked on the previous mission statement, 20 years ago. I value my status as a life member of this congregation, the certificate for which hangs in an honored place in my study. Of the headings in the new statement, the one with which I will work this morning is that of spiritual growth. I don't know how far I myself have grown spiritually, but I do know that this has been a concern of mine for as long as I can remember. I began the move that took me out of the church in which I had been raised and led me to become a Unitarian, not in the first instance because of intellectual difficulties with traditional dogmas, nor through a search for authentic community, though both of these soon followed, but because I felt a lack of spiritual depth in my experience in that original church, and I began to think this over. And just a few years later, when I was still only 22 years of age and had just come out of the Air Force into which I had been conscripted during the Second World War and was about to resume my undergraduate studies, I was already asked to deliver a sermon and ventured to choose as my subject spiritual maturity. I still have that sermon. And in view of the theme I want to address this morning, I got it out and looked at it for the first time in many, many years. Well, I hope I may have made some advance toward maturity since that long ago time. But I still wouldn't change the basic advice I then gave. Look at those who have climbed higher up the mountain than you have and follow their example, moving upward along your own path. What I didn't say then, and would want to stress now, is that this does not have to be a lonely quest. You're not all on your own. As I said a moment ago, the search for an authentic, supportive community soon began for me and brought me into fellowship with the Unitarians. But it was not until years later that I discovered the work of a person who had a tremendous influence upon my own spiritual evolution, Martin Buber. I can't take time now to talk about that influence at any length, but I do want to share with you a brief passage from one of his books. Listen. The primary aspiration of all history is a genuine community of human beings. Genuine because it is community all through, guarded against all contamination by sentimentality or emotionalism. A community of faith truly exists only when it is a community of work. The real essence of community is to be found in the fact, manifest or otherwise, that it has a center. The real beginning of a community is when its members have a common relation to the center, overriding all other relations. The circle is described by the radii, not by the points along the circumference. And the originality of the center cannot be discerned unless it is discerned as being transpicuous to the light of something divine. I find that imagery really powerful. We can join hands around a circle and feel we have community. But, says Buber, what is really important is what is in the center, the light of something divine. Is the discovery of that light what we mean when we speak of spiritual growth? In recent years, there's been a lot of talk about spirituality and a lot of questions as to what we mean when we use that word. My own response to such questions is that the closest synonym for spirituality is connectedness, by which I mean Buber's image of the circle. We are connected to one another as we link hands around the circumference. But more important, we are connected by the radii to that light of the center. The light, however impressive, is insubstantial. What's really at the center? And here let me turn to the wisdom of the great Chinese classic, the Tao Te Ching. Here's the way it sees the picture. 30 spokes converge in the hub of a wheel, but the usefulness of the wheel will depend on the part of the hub that is void. Clay is molded into a bowl, but the usefulness of a bowl will depend on the part of the bowl that is void. Void. Empty. Think about it. As I do so, my thoughts go back to the college at Oxford at which I received my theological training. As with most Oxford colleges, the main entrance is at the foot of a tower. And above the doorway is the dedication to truth, to liberty, to religion. But if you look further up, towards the top of the tower, you will see a niche. The kind of niche that on a Catholic building would be occupied by a statue of the Blessed Virgin, or of Christ exhibiting his Sacred Heart. But this college was built by Unitarians. The niche is empty. Nothing. I remember that the old Unitarian church in Montreal, which some of you may have known, had a niche of the same kind high up on the front. Or take a historical incident which has fascinated me ever since I first ran across it. It dates from a little over 2,000 years ago, a time when the expanding Roman Empire was taking its place among the successive powers that have dominated the Middle East. The little Jewish state, which had only recently become precariously independent, put up a surprisingly stiff resistance to Pompey, the Roman general, as he moved south. But his powerful army eventually crushed this opposition. The city walls of Jerusalem were breached, and the Romans poured in. There remained only the inner citadel, the fortified Temple Hill, on top of which stood the temple itself, the center of the people's life, and religion. After a desperate struggle, this too was taken by storm, and Pompey stood at the doors of the temple. Inside, he knew, was the secret of the stubborn resistance these people had put up against such overwhelming odds. Like the other nations he had conquered, they had put their hope and trust in a particular god. What, he wondered, would this god be like? A massive human form? Or one of the fantastic animal forms as in the temples of Egypt? He gave the signal. His men broke down the doors and he strode in. They moved through the outer courts on into the inner courts, the place of sacrifice, to be entered only by the priests. Beyond it lay the Holy of Holies, screened by heavy curtains, and to be entered only by the high priest on the most solemn of occasions. The Romans went over to the great curtains and swept them aside. Pompey walked boldly in. A gasp went up from everyone when they saw what was inside. No image, not even a picture. Nothing. The Holy of Holies was totally empty, and there was no evidence that it had ever been otherwise. This great temple that had been defended so tenaciously had only empty space in the middle. Void. Well, let's move now from the ancient world to the modern world for one more illustration of what I'm trying to say. The United Nations building in New York has what is called a meditation room. Years ago, a leading Unitarian Universalist minister, Walter Royal Jones, who actually chaired the committee which produced the seven principles so widely acclaimed among us, actually visited that room and memorably described it. And let me quote his words. "The walls," he said, "the walls converge as they extend away from the viewer, creating a curious psychological effect. For the eye receives conflicting signals as to the actual depth of the sanctuary, the focusing of the eye giving one hint and the exaggerated perspective of the lines where wall and floor meet giving another. And a similar ambiguity is created by the ceiling, which hangs free of the walls, with the light spilling over the edges from above. One does not know how high the walls really are. There is a strange sense that the room is invaded by a space larger than its obvious walls." And he went on to describe what is at the center of the room. Not, to be sure, a complete emptiness, but as apt a symbol of that as can be imagined, a simple block of stone. What the room was intended to convey was indicated by the then Secretary of General, Dag Hammarskjöld, when the room was dedicated. He said then, "There is an ancient saying that the sense of a vessel is not in its shell, but in the void. With what they find, it is for those who come here to fill the void with what they find in their center of stillness. And in his own account, Walter Royal Jones spoke of how it affected him. "One must not," he said, "come into this place with preconceptions. It is better to let the room with its enigmatic patterns pull out from within the patterns and meanings and fragments of meaning which feeling and memory supply. That in our meditation we may discover many meanings within ourselves and reorder them into a new and larger harmony. Come back again to those words of Dag Hammarskjöld. It is for those who come here to fill the void with what they find in their center of stillness. And that phrase, center of stillness, picks up what he said at the beginning of the ceremony of dedication. We all have within us a center of stillness surrounded by silence. This house, dedicated to work and debate in the service of peace, should have one room dedicated to silence in the outward sense and stillness in the inward sense. And that word of silence opens up another field for our meditation. It's not just that we are nonplussed like Pompey by not seeing anything in the void. Silence means that we don't hear anything either. The center of stillness lies far beyond anything accessible either by sight or by hearing. What the prominent 20th century theologian Paul Tillich called the holy void. Now, how do we Unitarians relate to all this? I've already referred to the empty niche on the college and the feelings of our minister as he went into the United Nations meditation room. As for empty space in place of words, you might think at first that we haven't really taken silence seriously, even though our services always nowadays have a token amount of it. But we would find it hard to relate to what an earlier Unitarian, Ralph Waldo Emerson, wrote. I like the silent church before the service begins better than any preaching. Most of our churches are anything but silent before the service begins. However, there is another kind of void in relation to silence that we do experience more often, and is sometimes commented on by newcomers to our services. If they've come from a background in which going to church entailed hearing the word God countless times in every service, they may notice how reticent, if not completely silent, we are in using it. I remember that one person who came to the Vancouver church during my ministry for a while wrote a long account of his experiences, which he headed up, A Church Without God. Pompey, I suppose, might have said the same about the temple in Jerusalem. And not being facetious in that reference to Pompey and the temple. The ancient Hebrews, for whom this was their holy of holies, had a much more stringent taboo on the use of the word God than we do, as expressed in number 3 of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. In other words, be extremely careful how and when you use it. Those who took their religion most seriously guarded themselves against inadvertently breaking that commandment by avoiding the use of the term altogether, using circumlocutions, and that has continued among the most stringent Jews right down to the present day. Even that expression, the Lord, is suspect, drawn as it is from human structures of aristocracy. When I'm quoting from the Bible, I usually translate it as the ineffable, which I think is truer to the spirit of the original writers. A verbal idol can be just as dangerous as a visual one. It narrows and constricts your range of thinking and feeling, your depth of worship. The ineffable. This brings me to the words of D.H. Lawrence that spurred my thinking on this topic today and gave me the title for the sermon, although as I began my exploration in greater depths, it fell back to this point in what I had to say. Lawrence was a poet and mystic rather than a theologian. But I have to say that in my own spiritual evolution, I have often gained a great deal more from the poets than I have from the theologians. At any rate, this is what Lawrence wrote. Forever nameless, forever unknown, forever unconceived, forever unrepresented, yet forever felt in the soul. Yes, not seen, not heard, but felt. This is where the heart of religion is, not in names or pictures or images, but in the feeling of the soul. People may argue forever about words, about dogmas or theories that are couched in words. They may argue about the appropriateness or otherwise of pictures and images and symbols. But what it comes right down to in the end is the feeling in the soul. And the way we give expression to that feeling in our practical conduct and in the shared life of the world. For what do we really find if we enter into the holy void? Come back to the examples I gave earlier. The Tao Te Ching looked at the spokes of a wheel converging on the empty space of the hub. That space makes it possible for the wheel to revolve around an axle. A word that calls to mind the axis mundi. That around which the whole world was thought to revolve. The Chinese classic spoke also of how the usefulness of a bowl consists of the emptiness it contains, an emptiness of potential. As when Buber spoke of the empty center as being transpicuous to the light of the divine. A light again which reflects from the rock in the UN meditation room. I described how moving I found that illustration of community as gathered in a circle, linking hands, if you will, but ultimately united, not by their relationship to one another, but by their shared relationship to the center. By the radii, not the circumference. This summer I've been reading a remarkable book called Circling the Sacred Mountain. And the authors describe their pilgrimage to Mount Kailash in Tibet, a place known to and revered by millions of Buddhists and Hindus, but so difficult of access that it is visited only by a few hundred people each year. It is so sacred that no one has ever dared to try to climb it. But since it stands in isolation from any continuous range, it is possible to do a circular tour around the base of it, taking several days. And the Tibetans picture a wonderful unseen temple on its summit, the home of the great god Shiva. So much for the world of creative imagination. In actual fact, of course, it wouldn't be necessary to climb it in order to see what is really on the summit. It could be inspected from the air, or even from a distant vantage point through a powerful telescope. So far as I can gather from photographs of what a climber who defied the prohibitions and went up there would in fact see, is what I saw years ago when I climbed to the summit of Mount Baker. Just a great expanse of snow without form or feature, and on the horizon a view over vast distances. Once again, as close an approximation as we could get to empty space. And the Tibetan Buddhists, writes Edwin Birnbaum in his book, Sacred Mountains of the World, the Tibetan Buddhists view Kailash with the invisible pagoda palace of the deity on its summit as the center of a mandala, or sacred circle, that represents the divine space, where they will come to know the power and wisdom to awaken to their own true nature and transform their experience of the world from a profane place of illusion into the sacred realm of ultimate reality. The pattern of such a mandala appears frequently in works of Tibetan art, depicting the universe as a circle of mountains, oceans, and continents arrayed around a mythical mountain at the very center, shooting up from the depths of hell to the heights of heaven and the great void that lies beyond. Well, where has this gathering around the holy void taken us? Before I close, I want to return again to that story of Pompey and the temple. As I said before, that story has fascinated me for a long while. And a major part of that fascination, I think, is that it can be viewed in a different kind of a way, as a parable. It would be a travesty to suggest that Pompey was making a religious pilgrimage. But nonetheless, it's uncanny to see how his breakthrough to the innermost sanctum parallels the personal pilgrimage we make in our own inner life as we seek spiritual growth. As Dag Hammarskjöld said, we all have within us a center of stillness. And those who have given us a roadmap for silent meditation tell us that to reach that center, we have to empty the mind. Engrossed as it usually is with everyday trivia or even with important plans and projects. We who have taken the liberal path in religion have often made the mistake of supposing that intellectual processes, left brain activities, lead us to enlightenment. I plead guilty. We've become very skilled in molding the clay to make the bowl, rather than attending to what the bowl will contain, the emptiness, the center of stillness, the holy void that will leave us open to a deeper understanding of who we are and what makes this life of ours meaningful. And again, like Pompey, we don't find that approach easy and wide open. But the outcome justifies the effort. Out of the depths, out of the emptiness, out of the silence, something emerges. If we are open, as Lawrence put it, to feel it in the soul. The story of the prophet Elijah in the Bible called it a still small voice. And where that voice originates is a question that pulls us back into intellectual processes that are not very fruitful. In that center of stillness, who knows what can be counted as part of the individual ego and what lies beyond? As Buber put it, it is transspicuous to the light of the divine. And Buber began with a circle. Last Sunday, I sat in a silent circle in a Quaker meeting, where together we sought that center of stillness and felt the strength of supportive community. A few days earlier, I walked a labyrinth in which the long and involved circular journey led to the empty space in the middle, and back out again into the wider world. Well, let me conclude with the words of a famous 19th century journal keeper, Henri Frédéric Amiel. Let mystery have its place in you. Leave a little fallow corner in your heart ready for any seeds the wind may bring. Keep a place in your heart for the unexpected guest, an altar for the unknown God.